for human rights, and the largest Israeli human rights organization, B'Tselem. So it makes it difficult to deny it. But you still have European and Western leaders nonetheless trying to deny it vehemently. Like you saw with Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, a few days ago, emphatically saying that there is no genocide in Gaza, to which the answer from the human rights community is just open your eyes and look at what's unfolding there. It's impossible to see what's happening and conclude that there's anything else but genocide unfolding.
I wanted to ask you as well. You were in Istanbul, Turkey, a few days before Israel bombed Doha. While you were there, the entire Hamas leadership in Istanbul took a flight to Doha to respond to Trump's proposal. Your response to this Israeli attack on those who were seeking to negotiate peace?
Absolutely. So Israel could have assassinated those Hamas leaders in Istanbul the day before they flew to Doha. They could have assassinated them in Tehran when they assassinated only Ismail Haniyeh. Or they could have done it right after October 7th. But they didn't do it in any of these instances because the Israeli military was telling Netanyahu, we need someone to talk to. What you have is basically Netanyahu laying a trap with Trump. Trump issuing a proposal last minute and then inviting and summoning Hamas to congregate in Doha to discuss and study it and articulate a counterproposal. And as soon as they entered into the meeting room, Israel drops the 10 bombs on the headquarters, the office of Hamas in Doha, to obliterate the negotiating table. So it was a premeditated, deliberate attack to kill any chance of a ceasefire happening in Gaza. Netanyahu did not want to take the least chance on Hamas approving or saying yes to Trump's proposal. And you have basically a White House that's willing to play along with it, no matter what Israel does. So you got reports basically saying that Trump was frustrated with Netanyahu and saying every time there's progress, Netanyahu sabotages it or bombs people. But at the same time, you had Marco Rubio immediately flying to Israel and saying there may not be a diplomatic solution for the war in Gaza. The military option is the only one, right on the day before Israel invades Gaza with everything they have. So basically, they're giving the absolute green light to the Israelis to turn Gaza into a howling wilderness, into this apocalyptic scene that cannot even be described in words. Like there is apocalypse, there's catastrophe, there's disaster, there's genocide, and then there is Gaza. It's beyond anything that the human language can capture at this moment.
Yes, you have Rubio saying sometimes when you're dealing with a group of savages like Hamas, that's not possible. He was talking about a ceasefire. And you have Netanyahu going to be visiting the White House for the fourth time since Trump took office this time. And you have thousands of Israelis protesting outside Netanyahu's house. He's being in trial for corruption, demanding an end to its war on Gaza. The significance of this?
Well, basically, right now, you have the entire Israeli military and members of the government, ministers from Netanyahu's government, saying this is enough. The job in Gaza has been accomplished. Gaza is no more already. What we need to do is basically prevent reconstruction in the war now, continue to carry out Lebanon-style assassinations and targeted bombings. No one's going to stop us. And the genocide can proceed slowly, quietly, and without even the public appearance of it. If you just lock Gaza, close it off, and give people only one option, leave or stay and perish. But on the other hand, you have Netanyahu, who is willing to burn everything, willing to turn Israel into a pariah state. He stood up in front of a podium 2 days ago and said that Israel was becoming Sparta and Israel was becoming increasingly isolated. He saw it as a positive thing that Israel is now standing against the whole world because he wants to be remembered as Winston Churchill / FDR, the person that oversaw a great disaster and then managed to achieve victory or at least an image of victory that would wipe away that shame from his reputation. On the other side, he wants to see the job in Gaza completed to the end. He doesn't believe that if Gaza City remains half destroyed or 70% destroyed, that this is enough to push people out. I have family in Gaza City who've literally burrowed underneath the rubble of their homes and chose to stay there instead of leaving southwards and sleeping on the street. So basically what you have is Netanyahu saying, I want to see it with my own eyes, that every single home, every single building in Gaza City is flattened completely, that there is absolutely nothing left there, and that the Gazan population would be overcrowded on the Egyptian Egyptian borders with conditions of an immense catastrophic disease outbreak and civic collapse so that Gazans themselves would invade the Egyptian borders, breach it, and cross in on their own. I asked Egyptian officials, what would you do in the event of Israel opening a major hole in the fence and pushing people into your territory at gunpoint? And they said, we will respond with force because this is a declaration of war. And then I rephrased the question. I said, what if Israel creates the conditions remotely that would drive Gazans on their own to open a hole in the fence and cross in? What would you do? And the answer unanimously was, no one in the Egyptian military would think about firing at fleeing civilians. So that's exactly what Netanyahu has in mind. Concentrate the population there, create conditions for disaster, and have them run towards Egypt on their own.
Mohammed Shahada, I want to thank you for being with us, writer and analyst from Gaza, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, speaking to us today from Copenhagen. Up next, the alleged shooter of Charlie Kirk, Tyler Robinson, formally charged with murder. Among the evidence against him, inscriptions written on bullets. We'll talk to a senior Wired reporter, McKenna Kelly, back in 20 seconds.
In the heart of the city, ain't no love in the heart of town, ain't no love, and it sure is a pity, ain't no love since you ain't around, oh, since you've been around.
Ain't No Love in the Heart of the City, rendition of Zeeshan B in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The alleged shooter of conservative activist Charlie Kirk was formally charged Tuesday by Utah prosecutors. 22-year-old Tyler Robinson faces charges of aggravated murder and six other counts. Prosecutors say they'll seek the death penalty. On Tuesday, prosecutors released the transcripts of text messages Robinson allegedly sent to his roommate, who's also his romantic partner, that he sent after the shooting. In one of the alleged messages, Robinson wrote about Charlie Kirk, quote, "I had enough of his hatred. Some hate can't be negotiated out," unquote. Robinson also texted his roommate after the shooting that he'd left a message under his keyboard. The message reportedly read, quote, "I had the opportunity to take out Charlie Kirk, and I'm going to take it," unquote. The messages showed the roommate was shocked that Robinson was the assassin. The roommate now is cooperating fully with investigators, according to the Utah governor. In the wake of Kirk's murder a week ago, the Trump administration's vowed a crackdown on the political left. But the motives and ideology of Robinson, whether or not he acted alone, are still mostly a subject of speculation. Some of the first evidence released in the case were inscriptions written on bullets found with a rifle. This is Utah Governor Spencer Cox reading some of the inscriptions.
Inscriptions on the three unfired casings read, "Hey fascist!" exclamation point, "Catch!" exclamation point, up arrow symbol, right arrow and symbol, and three down arrow symbols. A second unfired casing read, "Oh, Bella Chow, Bella Chow, Bella Chow, Chow, Chow." And a third unfired casing read, "If you read this, you are gay, LMAO.
We're joined now by senior writer at Wired, McKenna Kelly. Her latest piece is headlined, "Bullets Found After the Charlie Kirk Shooting Carried Messages. Here's What They Mean." Welcome to Democracy Now!, McKenna. If you can start off just by explaining, I mean, yesterday also in the questioning of the FBI director, Kash Patel, there was this whole discussion about Discord. And he says that everyone that he was communicating with, you know, apparently Tyler Robinson said on Discord, "I hate to tell you, I'm the one who did this." They're going to investigate all the people he was talking to. But Discord, the deep web, can you explain to people who are not familiar with all of this and then what these messages, how they may have been misinterpreted and what they mean?
Sure. Yeah. So Discord has become a huge messaging platform, especially for young people. It operates similarly to Slack, if you use Slack at all. So there's options to create a server, which is what your company would use, and then separate little channels divided into topics. So a Discord channel operates in the same way. There are different channels, oftentimes for groups of friends, like the one that it looks like Robinson was involved in, had a channel for probably memes, had a channel for like a general discussion, things like that. And so the people who use Discord, it's a variety of folks for a variety of different purposes. They could just be kind of a friendly group chat, something that maybe you would have on your messages app on your phone, with a little bit more direction or topic and some more niche focuses. But also Discords can be used for a bunch of different things. I have friends in the New York area, actually, who use Discord for political organizing and for bringing folks that they meet, you know, on the streets, or helping organize voting drives and things like that. And so it's not necessarily a political platform. It is a very like politically neutral platform that people use because it serves a certain purpose. But that doesn't get away from the fact that people who are involved, deeply involved and deeply, you know, indebted to the internet, who get on it every day, who maybe are accessing stranger forms than you or I do every day, they're able to organize and bring people from those maybe deeper, darker places of the internet, bring them to Discord and be in touch with them basically at any moment every day.
And Makena, FBI Director Kash Patel, during an interview on Fox News, said that Tyler Robinson, quote, subscribed to left-wing ideology. Can you talk about this idea that Robinson's motives may not be rooted in traditional extremism, but constructed from randomness and irony of online culture?
Yeah, if you even look at the documents that came out yesterday, the charging documents for Robinson, in the text exchange that they show, these transcripts, he specifically notes that, like, I will die laughing or something like that if Fox News reads some of the memes that I have inscribed on these bullets. So all of these memes themselves are not inherently political. Hey, fascist, sure, that can be read, you know, as maybe being a bit leftist. It can also be seen to be maybe ironic. And until we actually get some idea of the communities that Robinson was involved in, then we'll get a better idea of what he ascribed to. But these memes are everywhere online. You would have people using them ironically, people using them perhaps, you know, seriously. But there, we just don't have enough information to go off of right now to really make any real decision on what it is that Robinson ascribed to.
And McKenna, can you talk about video game culture and the up and down arrows and how they are being misread, and how you talked about particular games they're from as opposed to a leftist ideology?
Yeah, so the first bullet casing that they mentioned in that press conference said, hey, fascist, catch. And then it had an up and then a right and then three downward arrows. At the beginning of this investigation, a lot of folks were saying that those three downward arrows were an anti-fascist symbol. But when you add those additional first two arrows, it's actually just a code that you would input when playing a game called Helldivers 2, which is a satirical anti-fascist game where you're playing as what the characters believe to be anti-fascist, but you really are the fascists. So it's just a game that folks play. The bomb that code calls for is like this thing called an Eagle 500 kilogram bomb or something. And it's a meme in the community of Helldivers where it's seen as, when you call that down, it is a comically excessive bomb to drop. It will just basically, in the game, it'll solve all of your problems and you don't have to think about anything else. And so instead of looking at that bullet casing and saying like, oh, this is a leftist ideology, right? You could look at it coming from the community around the folks who play this game, be like, oh, I'm doing something perhaps comically excessive in assassinating this man, fortunately. And trying to send that sign, right? Trying to make it a joke and a meme, something that we kind of saw him reference in the charging documents yesterday.
Well, we will, of course, continue to follow this case. I think the funeral next Sunday. McKenna Kelly, I want to thank you for being with us. Senior writer at Wired. We'll link to your piece as you focus on the intersection of politics, power, and technology. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we go to Memphis, Tennessee, where President Trump has authorized sending the National Guard. Stay with us.
We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome. One day.
Roger Waters performing We Shall Overcome, accompanied by Alexander Roatan on cello in the Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we turn now to Memphis, Tennessee, after President Trump on Monday signed an order authorizing the deployment of National Guard and the creation of a so-called safe task force, which Trump claims will address violent crime in the city. Trump's order came as Memphis Police Department reported crime is at a 25-year low, with robbery, larceny, burglary all at record lows over the past 8 months. Tennessee Democrats gathered in Memphis Monday to condemn Trump's crackdown. We're joined by Justin J. Pearson, Democratic Tennessee State Representative. State Rep, thanks so much for being with us. If you were one of the people who spoke out against the National Guard deployment, why?
This is an abuse of power by the Trump administration. It is moving us from a democracy to an authoritarian regime led by a wannabe dictator. We cannot normalize the behavior of the nationalization of the federalization of the National Guard against our own citizens, against our own communities. If they really wanted to address the problems of crime, they would address billions of dollars of disinvestment as it relates to eradicating poverty. They would make sure that we do something about gun safety laws. But this is not about that. This is about taking away our power, targeting and attacking Black-led majority cities and destroying our democracy for their own political gain.
And Representative, on Monday, President Trump met with your governor, Bill Lee, with two U.S. senators, Marsha Blackburn and Bill Hagerty. And Governor Lee said, I've been in office for 7 years. I'm tired of crime holding the great city of Memphis back. But this is really in contrast to the plummeting crime rate in Memphis at a 25-year low. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, the statistics do not net out for what they are articulating, but Governor Bill Lee has been governor for nearly 8 years and has never once presented a plan to reduce and eradicate poverty in Memphis, Tennessee, has not fought for any legislation to reduce gun violence and have gun violence prevention laws against his own party. He's not exercised the political will or the desire to address any of the root causes and the systemic problems that we have. This is giving Donald Trump and this administration more power to take over communities that they disagree with, that are Democratic-led, for their own political gains. And this gets much more scary for some folks when it's an election season and the National Guard is going to be posted up in front of our polls. That's going to happen at the midterms. That's likely to happen during the presidential election. This is not what is supposed to be happening in our country. And we all need to be unified and realizing that this is nothing more than a power play for more authoritarianism from this administration.
Justin J. Pearson, you've talked about Trump manipulating racist rhetoric to perpetuate false claims of rising crime waves in cities like Memphis. Elaborate.
Absolutely. Look, it is no coincidence that the cities that Donald Trump and this administration are targeting have been overwhelmingly Black-led cities. Karen Bass in Los Angeles, in Chicago, sought to attack Baltimore, now here in Memphis. The idea of Black criminality is something that has been perpetuated by racists and white supremacists like Donald Trump for centuries. And so it is not new to us. It is not unfamiliar that Governor Bill Lee is perpetuating this. Marsha Blackburn, Bill Hagerty are also perpetuating the lie lie about Black criminality and not taking accountability or responsibility for taking away access to health care, eliminating SNAP benefits through the big ugly bill that just recently passed, transferring wealth to the richest people in the world and taking from the poorest people, and then dealing with those consequences. They say, well, you all are the problem. It isn't the policies we push. It isn't the laws that we've done to make it harder for you to live and to survive. It is you. It is you Black folks who are in power that are the problem. It is not the policies and the laws and our inaction that is the consequences that you all are dealing with. And today we are dealing with the consequences of people who are in positions of power who do not care about our lives, who do not care about our communities, who don't care about eliminating poverty. They don't even care about crime. They're doing this as a part of an authoritarian regime to take more power and to see how far we are willing to go to allow them to destroy our democracy. And in Memphis, in Shelby County, we are saying no.
Well, Justin J. Pearson, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Democratic state representative whose district includes parts of Memphis. He is also the subject of a new documentary that premiered at the Telluride Film Festival called This Is Not a Drill. We'll be talking about that in the weeks to come, about his activism before becoming a Tennessee state representative. Thanks so much for joining us from Memphis. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show with the late Robert Redford in his own words. The legendary Oscar-winning director, actor, and activist died at his home in Sundance, Utah at the age of 89 Tuesday. In addition to being a Hollywood icon, Robert Redford was a longtime environmental activist who served for 50 years as a trustee of the Natural Resources Defense Council. He was also the creator of the Sundance Film Festival, where I would often interview him over the last decade. This is part of an interview we did in 2015 in Park City.
I think the deniers of climate change are probably people who are afraid of change. They don't want to see change. They want to hang on to the way things were. And my feeling about the deniers and a lot of other issues that are out there is that too many in Congress are pushing us back into the 1950s. That's what it feels like. They're pushing us back in time rather than forward in time. And I think why is the reason? Maybe they're afraid of not being able to be included. I don't know what it is, but it's kind of sad because it's so polarized, you know, it's so mean-spirited. And
they also often say that we need this oil to move forward in America.
Well, we also need alternative energy, too. I mean, I think that's the future. I don't think oil is the future. I think it should probably stay. And this is going to be an unpopular view, but I think, because I worked in an oil field as a kid. I worked in the Chevron oil fields in California. So I've had a lot of experience with oil. I think it should stay in the ground now. And I think that we're so close to polluting the planet beyond anything sustainable. I think we better say, let's stop this argument about alternative energy is not going to produce enough jobs. And to me, that's a mistake because it would produce an industry, and an industry would produce jobs. So I think somebody's got to speak up for the fact that alternative energy is the way of the future, not oil, certainly not coal and gas. So that's my feeling.
And your thoughts on the oil barons, the Koch brothers? It's just been announced that they and their allied groups will pour $900 billion into the next election, doubling what they did in the last election, $900 million into the next election.
Money's the name of the game. I mean, I think money is what moves the ball, and they're moving the ball in their direction. I think it's the wrong direction. It's very narrow-minded, but they have the money to do it, so it's a free country.
So some people might be saying right now, why am I talking to this famous actor, an Oscar-winning director, about issues like the environment and money and politics?
Well, because I've been I guess you could call me an activist since 1969. I've been involved in the environment from the standpoint of wanting to draw attention to what an alternative could be rather than what we've been having. And I remember when I was at a conference in Vail, Colorado, and they talked about where All the energy was going, all the effort, the energy, the money was going to oil, gas, coal, and nothing was being contributed to the alternative energy. And I thought, well, why? This stuff is going to run out. It's not infinite. It's going to run out. And it's costly. And it pollutes our planet. If somebody doesn't start thinking about what we're going to develop for our survival, because I think we are a development-oriented society, it's going to be a question of what we develop for our survival and what we preserve for our survival. And I think there's been little to no talk about preservation, because those people that you're talking about, the McConnells and people like that, they're living so far in the past. They're living so much in the past. It seems like they're afraid of the future.
Can you believe that the Sundance Film Festival is 31 years old?
No.
Do you think of it as one of your children?
You know, it's interesting. I think of it, because it started, it was a big idea back in 1985. It was a big idea with a small start, because there was no support. There was only one theater in Park City. Sundance, the place, is not here in Park City. It's 40 miles away, higher up in the mountains, tucked away. That's where our lab programs are. That's where the development process is. That's where our nonprofit, Sundance Development, for the documentaries and the film and the theater and so forth, music. Park City works out for us because they have something we need, which is theatrical distribution capability. And we give them something they need, which is a venue to attract people. So the first year, there was maybe 150 people that showed up. We had one theater, maybe 10 documentaries and 20 films. And now it's grown to the point where it's kind of like a wild horse. You know, I can't begrudge it. I mean, that was the dream. It started as just a hope. And then when it became a reality, it started to have its own momentum.
And the point of it, since you certainly, you know, have great acclaim in Hollywood, you didn't need another venue, as all the creative ways you participate in the film industry, as director, as an actor. So why Sundance? You had it made.
In 1980, the industry began to be more centralized, and they were following the youth market because that's where the money was, which I understand. But it looked like it was going to be at the expense of some of those other films that were more about the humanistic side of cinema, stories about America, American way of life, complex stories. And so in my mind, I thought that was very valuable. I thought that's a wonderful use of film. You can have the big blockbusters. You can have, with technology coming along, creating more special effects possibilities. You knew that they were going to use that, and that's great. But I felt it was going to be at the expense of giving up those other kinds of films, so that's what led to Sundance. I thought, well, what if we can start a development process where young artists can have a voice, but we can help them develop their skills so they can at least get their films made. That was the lab that started in 1980. Then, once that happened and we started a development process at Sundance, suddenly realized that we were helping them develop their skills so they could get their films made, but there was nowhere to go because the mainstream had not allowed any space for them. And that led to the idea of a festival. So originally it was just an idea that maybe we can have a community of filmmakers coming together and share each other's work. And maybe if we're lucky, somebody will come, somebody else will come.
The Oscar-winning director, actor, and activist Robert Redford, speaking on Democracy Now! In one of a number of interviews we did with him at the Sundance Film Festival in Park City, Utah. That interview in 2015. He died on Tuesday at the age of 89 at his home in Utah. The Sundance Film Festival will be moving after this next year from Park City to Boulder. Robert Redford served for 5 decades as a trustee of the Natural Resources Defense Council. Manish Bapna, president and CEO at NRDC, said, quote, "The environmental movement has lost a giant. Nobody has done more to shine a light on the most important environmental issues from the dawn of the environmental movement in the 1970s through the biodiversity and climate crises of today." Again, Robert Redford, dead at the age of 89, but his legacy continues. You can go to democracynow.org for all of our interviews. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Hello. This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.
Please enjoy 30 seconds of nature, brought to you by Ducks Unlimited Canada. Learn how you can experience nature in your community at ducks.ca.